News and analysis, local, national, and international. Monday nights, 7 p.m. We build bridges. And it's time we started
calling the shots. Building Bridges with Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg at 7 p.m. this evening. You're tuned to 99.5 FM, WBAI, WBAI.org on the web. It's 10 a.m. Coming up next, Bike Snob with Eben Weiss.
Hello, you're listening to Bike Snob on WBAI. I'm Eben Weiss. 1 week ago, on Monday, Congressman Adriano Espaillat spoke at the Reverend Al Sharpton's annual Martin Luther King Day event. He mentioned bike lanes, and here is what he had to say.
I think King would have looked at this and would have taken this on, and affordability and gentrification is ripping our neighborhood apart. And you see the stress of high rent. And now you got Starbucks and bike lanes and sushi. And where's my rice and beans?
Okay, Starbucks, bike lanes, and sushi, the three-headed monster destroying our neighborhoods. Okay, so we have massive income inequality in the city. Rising rent is a huge problem. People are angry, and these are big problems. People want to blame this stuff on something. Brooklyn Borough President Eric Adams, at this same event, blamed it on transplants from Iowa and Ohio. You probably heard last week, which there was a big backlash over. Statistically, transplants from Iowa and Ohio are numerically insignificant. As for Espaillat, he seems to be blaming Starbucks bike lanes. This is Bike Snob, so we're talking about bike lanes and sushi. But before I get to the bike lanes, I just want to look at the other agents he mentions here. Okay, so Starbucks. In 2018, someone at Harvard Business School or something like that did a paper and found when a Starbucks comes into a zip code, the real estate prices go up 0.5%, not 5%, 0.5%. They do go up. However, according to the paper, quote, "The most natural hypothesis to us is that restaurants respond to exogenous changes in neighborhood composition, not that restaurant availability is driving neighborhood change," the paper concludes. All right, in English, that means, I guess, that customers, new people are coming to this neighborhood, and the Starbucks is following them, which, you know, seems like common sense. I mean, Starbucks is definitely part of this bland retail monoculture that characterizes 21st century America, and which is lamentable for a number of reasons. But I think it's a tough argument to say that people are moving to a neighborhood because of the Starbucks. Sushi. Let's go to sushi. This is kind of a weird one, the sushi. The first thing I thought of when Espaillat said sushi was a restaurant called Mama Sushi. There's one in Harlem and one on Dyckman Street, which are both in his district. In 2012, as a state senator, Espaillat presented Susanna Osorio, owner of Mama Sushi, with the Northern Manhattan Business Leadership Award. So, what, sushi's evil now? That seems a little unfair. I don't know. Maybe he regrets the monster he created. Maybe Mama Sushi's taking over Upper Manhattan. I don't know. Okay, so those are Starbucks, sushi, bike lanes. All right, bike lanes. This show is Bike Snob. I have no personal stake in Starbucks or in sushi. I mean, I do drink Starbucks. I do eat sushi. Not at the same time. But I don't care what people say about either of those things. And I know perfectly well when I'm drinking Starbucks, I'm paying way too much for burnt coffee. Okay, but bike lanes. This is bike snob. Bike lanes is different. He's talking about bike lanes now. It seems really unfair and deeply disingenuous to suggest that bike lanes are ripping neighborhoods apart. I mean, that's what he says there. He says, King would have taken this on. Gentrification is ripping neighborhoods apart. And then he says, now we have Starbucks and bike lanes and sushi. He's really angry. His tone is very angry. And it's very mocking. I kind of want to listen to this clip again, if we could play it one more time. I just want to listen, really take in his tone when he mentions bike lanes.
I think King would have looked at this and would have taken this on. And affordability and gentrification is ripping our neighborhood apart. And you see the stress of high rent. Now you got Starbucks and bike lanes and sushi. And where's my rice and beans?
All right, he sounds like he's yelling at a waiter at the end there, like he's sitting at the table and the waiter's slow with his rice and beans. But, you know, he really is mocking when he says bike lane. You can hear a little laughter in the background. Are bike lanes ripping neighborhoods apart? So let's talk about this. And I'm going to be taking your calls in a little bit. The number to call is 212-209-2877. Please call in a little bit, but first let's discuss this a little bit more. Let me discuss it a little bit more. Okay, the household car ownership rate in Espaillat's district is just about the lowest in the entire city. And by extension, that means it's the lowest car ownership rate in the United States, because as New Yorkers, we have the lowest car ownership rate as a city, and this is a part of the city that has rock bottom car ownership rates. You're talking about probably 3/4 of the households, at least in this district, do not have cars. Not only that, not only do they not have cars, but they don't have bike lanes either. And that's what's really wrong here. That's what's really unfair. Not bike lanes coming in, but bike lanes not coming in. An NYU graduate student did a study last year. You can read this study. You can see it on Streets blog. They covered this, in which they gave neighborhoods across the city letter grades for bike infrastructure. And by and large, not surprising, the best grades for bike infrastructure are in wealthier neighborhoods. The worst grades are in poorer neighborhoods. Now, it's not quite that simple. There are wealthy neighborhoods in more car-centric parts of the city that got lousy grades on the bike infrastructure test, or whatever you want to call this. But by and large, the city has historically made the most investment as far as bike lanes, safe streets, in the wealthier neighborhoods. And it's a real stretch to say that those investments are what made those neighborhoods wealthy, or what drove them to gentrify somehow. The places that got bike lanes first are in or close to what they call the central business district. So, you know, downtown, midtown Manhattan. These neighborhoods, the writing was on the wall. The development was already happening. And guess what? They got upgraded infrastructure first. So, you know, the shameful thing isn't bike lanes coming in and somehow making the rent go up. The shameful thing is that the city didn't focus on the most neglected neighborhoods first. It's a top-down approach that in some ways isn't too different from this idea of lowering taxes on rich people is going to make the rest of us benefit because these magnanimous rich people are going to pay the rest of us more. So, you know, in that sense, I can't blame people for being resentful of bike lanes. I do see how they can seem like the gilded edges on the fancy neighborhoods, the gilded edges of these pages. I live in the Bronx. There are very few bike lanes around me. Even I get angry when I come down here to Brooklyn to do this show and I see how many bike lanes there are. And I'm vociferously pro-bike lane. I want more of them. So, yes, I get it. I get why they can make you angry. But to say that they to lump them in with these things that are ruining neighborhoods or tearing them apart is to look at it backwards. Espaillat should know better. In fact, I'm sure he does know better. But, you know, it's easy to go for that low-hanging fruit. It's easy to go for this idea of the Ohio transplant or the bike lane or Starbucks or whatever. So I'm going to be taking your calls today. 212-209-2877 is going to be the number to call. I have some calls. WBAI. Oh, okay. Just a moment. Well, take your calls in just a moment. Funnily enough, the very next day, also in Harlem, at the Harlem YMCA, Lyft, the rideshare company, Lyft, by the way, operates City Bike. Lyft announced something at the Harlem YMCA the day after Espaillat's talk. They announced something called the Lyft Up program. And basically, they're teaming up with the Y to give young people between the ages of 16 and 20 free bike share memberships. There were 50 kids at this press conference, and LeBron James made a surprise appearance at this press conference at the Harlem Y to give these 50 kids their free City Bike membership. So let's listen to what LeBron James had to say at this press conference.
Thank you.
Okay, so that was LeBron James on bikes, and I'm going to talk a little bit about that, but first I have a caller, WBAI, you're on the air. What's your name? Where are you calling from?
Yes, good morning. My name is Emmanuel, and I'm calling from Brooklyn.
Yeah, hi, Emmanuel. How are you?
How you doing? Okay. I happen to be one of the people who believe that bike lanes are part of an overall infrastructural change that's going on. That leads to gentrification. It's not the reason for gentrification. It leads to it because it literally leads people who normally wouldn't go into certain neighborhoods into those neighborhoods. And I think it becomes a way of exploring areas. And when people see people who don't live in the community in that community and they're looking and they're taking pictures, and it leads to a kind of paranoia. And I can understand it because it is low-hanging fruit in one sense because you can pick on it. But it's just like when artists used to move into a community and all of a sudden you have all of these million-dollar apartments that used to be, you know, artist lofts. All of a sudden, they turn into, luxury residents. And we have to kind of, I hear a certain cynicism in your voice. Maybe it's unintentional, but you have to recognize it from the people, from their point of view, who share these, who are in these communities that have nowhere else to go. They can't go to Ohio. They can't go to another state and just transplant themselves and make do there. They're New Yorkers, and there's no place for them to go. So there's a certain amount of frustration when they see people riding around on bikes who they never seen in their life, and those people are not a part of the community because we've been socialized or socially engineered to not deal with each other like that anymore. It's not like the 70s or even the 80s. There's a kind of disconnect. The people who go to Starbucks don't go to a mom-and-pop restaurant around the corner. Those are people who want to stay away. And if they see people that look a certain way in Starbucks, they feel funny about it. So we really got to take these things, really not blaming the victim, but understanding it with a more sympathetic eye. And it's not gentrification. It's land reclamation.
Okay.
And that's what I want to say on
it. All right. No, I appreciate that take on it. You know, any cynicism, I have a tone. I'm a sarcastic person. And, you know, my cynicism is not meant at all to discount these concerns. And as I said in the beginning, I mean, yes, this is a big problem. All of this stuff you're mentioning what Espaillat is talking about is a big problem. I think where it gets a little tricky and it gets a little dangerous is if we're to say that, okay, you're positing that perhaps bike lanes as they expand throughout the city are encouraging people to explore, and they're discovering a certain kind of person is discovering a kind of place, their neighborhood that they didn't know about before, and is going to come in and decide they want to, set up camp there, whatever, take over, whatever the case may be. I take issue with that. I don't think that you can say that bike lanes are doing that. I think that, you know, at a certain, you have neighborhoods that are changing. You have people with money moving to places where they didn't move before. I really don't think that it's bike lanes that are doing these things. You know, you mention artists, and certainly this is very true that artists come in and other people follow, and then suddenly things get expensive. I mean, that's, you know, you can't say there shouldn't be art before. You can't blame art for that, and you certainly can't blame bike lanes for that. You know, that's a phenomenon totally unrelated to bike lanes. The kind of cop out take would be that this stuff is sort of is inevitable. I don't want to say that because it's an easy thing to say that's inevitable, that people are going to move to these places and that's the way it's going to be. But I don't think it's fair to say that it's bike lanes doing it. I think my feeling, again, as I said, is that the thing that this would be a totally different story and people would discuss it in a totally different way if these bike lanes first came to neighborhoods that had previously been neglected by the city, neighborhoods where there was poor transit, neighborhoods where the streets were dangerous. If the city had started there instead of starting in the places where there's already money or where they're teeing up a neighborhood to do a bunch of new development, I think all of us would be having a much different conversation about bike lanes and a different take on bike lanes. And I would also say that, you know, it's important to keep in mind, as I said also in the beginning, that, you know, Espaillat's district, very low household car ownership income, not income, car ownership rates. And why do so many people seem to assume that these bike lanes are only going to be utilized for people by people coming from elsewhere? They can be and are being utilized by these communities, and they should be. So, you know, the reason, but I thank you for that call, and I appreciate it. And the reason I wanted to segue to the LeBron James, to his comments at the Harlem Y, is so you have Espaillat bundling bike lanes in with gentrification and tearing neighborhoods apart, and here you have LeBron James saying a bike gave him mobility and freedom. A bike got him to basketball practice and football practice. I mean, that the fact that Lyft is a company with a $14 billion market cap that benefits from press like this is not lost on me, not by a long shot. But it's very hard to talk about being cynical. It's very hard to be cynical about what LeBron James is saying. He's saying a bike gave him the freedom to get to practice. A bike gave him the freedom to get around Akron. A bike got him where he needed to go. You know, I talked to some of these kids after the press conference. I talked to one kid who was really happy about this membership because he hadn't had a bike in 2 years. Now he could start riding it again. It's not easy to be a young person to have a bike in the city. They cost money. They get stolen. You might not have someplace to keep it. We had Shabazz Stewart from Uni on last week, who's trying to create bike parking, secure bike parking across the city. And that's forgetting how dangerous it can be to ride a bike in New York. So to give a kid an opportunity to safely ride, to give young people an opportunity to safely ride bikes in their neighborhood is really priceless. Whatever the household car ownership rates are in a given neighborhood, 100% of kids under the age of 18 or 17 or whatever the licensing age is can't have driver's licenses. They can't have cars if they want one. Buses, yes. Subways, yes. But they need more mobility. Bikes give them that mobility. To give kids in neighborhoods safe mobility on bikes is just so huge and so important. So that's just another reason I hear this Espaillat thing, and it's kind of cringeworthy. I'm going to take more calls. 212-209-2877 is the number. WBAI, you're on the air. What's your name? Where are you calling from?
Hi, my name is John. I'm calling from New York City.
Hi, John.
No, nothing. So I think your show is great, very interesting. The bicycle is going to definitely be like key to the Green New Deal. But the only trouble, and it's an amazing thing to think that you could pedal it with your feet. It's not just like some machine, like a treadmill that you go on. It's got this gyroscope action that makes it be able to balance easily on two tiny tires and make all kinds of turns and stuff. It's actually ideal for the city. My question was, and I want to add on a little bit to what the other call said. My question was, I think like whenever anything is having a renaissance, like bikes are having a renaissance now, so much so you said it's hard to get a bike. No, I disagree. I see 1,000 of bikes that are just thrown away, like decent bikes. When we were kids, we'd have got that bike and fixed it up.
Oh, yeah.
There's no way that you wouldn't. I see so many bikes trashed. But anyway, that's not even the point. It's like a renaissance of bicycles now, but you know what's happening? These motorized bicycles, I don't know. I mean, those things are like a machine. That thing is heavy and fast. And I don't know about you, but around here, they go on the sidewalk. They go the wrong way on the wrong way street. Forget about the bike lane, gentrification. It's like they wouldn't even, a lot of times you don't even see them in the bike lane. They're like all over the place, and they drive so uncautious. How could that not be regulated by a Department of Motor Vehicle?
They okay. No, I appreciate it. You know, I actually, if you'll stay tuned, I actually am hoping to get to that a little later on in the program. I was going to bring that up as sort of a part two, e-bikes and regulation and so forth. There is legislation in the works, and to address the legality of e-bikes. Absolutely. So so please bear with me. We'll get to that a little bit later on. But thanks for that. I'm going to take some more calls. 212-209-2877 is the number. WBAI, you're on the air.
Hello. Good morning.
Good morning.
This is Brenda calling. I'm listening to your program, which is very insightful from the perspective that you are presenting. What I'm observing is this. When the Caucasians were moving over from Manhattan because they could not afford the rent, they came into Brooklyn where the rents were lower. And the bikes were prepared for primarily for them because then they would save on transportation. I observed them going up and down on what they would have spent with the $2.75 and the transfers would have costed them more for the changes, whereas with the bike they can ride much longer. Now, for the folk living in these neighborhoods in Brooklyn where the Caucasians came in, what we had was at the same time storage places being built. And then the owners of those buildings began raising the rent beyond the reach of these people in Brooklyn, but within the reach of those coming in from Manhattan. So they opened up the storage places so that the low-income folk had a place to put their properties because they were being put out of their apartments. So, I don't know if you think that we are not observing it, what is happening. It's like Hitler moving in and telling the Jewish people, listen, we are about this, we're moving on, so you need to get out. And he told black people that, by the way, because there were black people killed in Germany, okay? So there is a similarity with this behavior. And then when you go downtown, who are the majority property owners pacing up and down in the housing courts? Go take a look. I'm really concerned about what you're saying. I don't know if you understand the other side. Maybe you haven't walked that road or you have moved out of it, so you can't relate to it. But they built the storage places in preparation for what they were going to do to these low-income people here.
Who built which storage places are you referring to?
Go around in Brooklyn.
You mean all the storage places around the BQE?
Listen, not just BQE. Go over to East New York. There are a whole lot of them built here.
Okay.
Go right over to the intersection of Empire Boulevard, Utica Avenue.
Okay.
A lot of these buildings went up just in time, okay? We know about data, too, so please don't disrespect.
No, I'm not disrespecting you. Not, I don't know about the store. Who is building these storages? I assume these are private company. I assume these are developer, whoever, real estate people are building these storage places. It's probably I assume the economics of building a storage place are probably very good for the people who are building them. And it's very easy to throw up a storage place and take people's money to store their stuff. And it's quite a good racket because as soon as you put stuff in a storage unit, you're going to keep it in there. You never take it out again, and it's a way to it's a way to keep bilking money out of people. And I'm not in favor of using space in a city that needs housing for storage. I cringe when I see these storage places all over the city. It's not a good use of space. Or as you say, people need places to live. And yes, people are getting priced out of their neighborhoods. All of this stuff is terrible. I agree. But by the same token, I mean to say that the Hitler comparison, the Nazi comparison, I think was going a little bit too far. And to say. I don't know. I also would ask you why you're assuming that the bike lanes are there for Caucasians and are only being used by them. That's the part I'm sort of confused about. And I'm also, it's true. It's numerically true that as neighborhoods, as people with more money move into neighborhoods, guess what they bring with them? They bring cars. They bring more and more cars. The car ownership rate is going up in the city. Cars take up street space. A bike lane is there for anybody to use. As I was saying, a kid in a a kid in the community can use a bike lane, and it's something that can allow a kid to get around their neighborhood safely on a bicycle. A bike lane makes the street safer for the people who live there. You know, the idea that they were put there so, you know, as you say, Caucasians can get around more cheaply, I don't think that that's really, really, really borne out. And as I said, you know, the idea that that is what is bringing new people into a neighborhood, I just don't think that I don't agree with that. I don't see that. I do see all the problems that you're talking about, and they're very, very real. I think that it's dangerous and unfortunate that you know, so many of us are inclined to go to street safety projects and sort of lump them in with all of these things that are making neighborhoods less livable for people. And I understand the rising costs. You know, I understand. I have a mother who's not working anymore, who's in a neighborhood where things have become much more expensive. And yes, city bikes come in, bike lanes have come into her neighborhood. All these things have come into her neighborhood. If she wanted to downsize her living arrangement in her neighborhood, she can't do it because the neighborhood has become more expensive. You know, I'm a fortunate person in life. At the same time, I do understand, and I am affected by some of these concerns, and I am sensitive to them. But I think to go to bike lanes as the problem is dangerous. But I do thank you. I'll take one more call. WBAI, you're on the air. What's your name? Where are you calling from?
Hey, it's Bob in Colorado Springs again.
Hi, Bob.
Hi. Boy, you opened a can of worms. Listen, I am a little bit older than you,
mm-hmm.
and I know I sound, I'm a white Jew, but I'm married into a black family, and I was very close to my father-in-law, who my mother-in-law lives with us. We grew up in, they grew up in the Depression in Texas, black,
mm-hmm.
and so I just wanted to share a few things. After the Civil Rights Movement, Dr. King went on to begin the Poor People's Campaign. And while he was against gentrification, he was also for equal access and a leveling of services and of living conditions. And if the rest of the city has bike infrastructure, then Dr. King, I am confident, would have been for bike infrastructure in predominantly brown and minority and poor. I mean, it wasn't even a question of skin of color. It was poor. That was the Poor People's Campaign. It was for civil equality. Secondly, outside of New York, there are complaints in major cities that power plants and factories are located or they coexist with traditionally black and poor neighborhoods. And, of course, bike lanes help cut down on auto traffic and allows minority. I'm going to use the, what do you have there, councilman, alderman? I don't know. What
city council. Yeah.
The Meshuggah, who was talking against bike lanes, he
Well, he's a congressman, but yeah, go anyway.
Okay, so it's a healthier choice for minorities and people of color. As far as being disenfranchised from the bike revolution, just, what was it, 2 weeks ago, you had Stuart Shabazz on, a black entrepreneur with his Uni bike storage. And also, you know, there are blogs and podcasts like Michelle Cook, the Quick Brown Fox, or Quick Brown Foxes, who are advocates for specifically women of color to embrace a healthier, less expensive lifestyle and be bike-centric. This us versus them, this is our neighborhood. I understand the problems with gentrification. We're having that problem here in Colorado, with thanks to Denver and urban sprawl. I mean, cities grow, prices go up, but to wish to remain, but to say that bike lanes are an agent of gentrification is wrong. They are avenues of opportunity. They are avenues of opportunity for economic help. They are avenues of opportunity for physical health. I mean, get off the couch. I mean, people wouldn't say that, wouldn't complain about basketball leagues and after school athletics. This is something. And then if you look at Los Angeles and Oakland, which of course are not as reliant on public transportation as New York, I mean, it's more car centric. You have that whole culture of the black and Hispanic bike co-ops, which not only teach, which not only provide mobility and for minority youth, but also provides them some semblance of what do you call that vocation? You know, they learn how to work mechanical skills. It's a complete success, and it's. And bike lanes are an avenue to this success. And I understand the dangers of gentrification, but bike lanes and bike cultures and bike culture is empowering. And anybody who doesn't recognize that probably is clouded by their own racist view of the world.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you. Thank you for that. Thank you for the call. I do think it's unfortunate that we, tend to make assumptions about bikes and people who ride bikes that are not accurate. And, you know, we're going to take a short break here. When I come back, I'll take more of your calls.
Hi, this is Bobby Humphrey. You're listening to WBAI New York. 99.5 FM.
New York City's park system is one of our greatest assets, a place to escape, to relax and enjoy a bit of nature by yourself or with kids and pets. So why is the city still using outdated toxic pesticides on our parks? Hi, I'm Patty Wood, co-host of Green Street here on WBAI. And this Tuesday morning, Doug and I will be talking with City Councilman Ben Kalos, who has authored a bill to ban those pesticides in our parks, and will tell you how you can help. That's Green Street, Tuesday morning at 10, right here on WBAI.
Okay, this is Bike Snob on WBAI. I'm Evan Weiss. I'm taking your calls, 212-209-2877. We're talking about bike lanes and tearing neighborhoods apart. WBAI, you're on the air. What's your name? Are you calling from?
Yes, good morning.
Good morning.
Yeah, hey, how you doing?
Good.
Yeah, I'm listening to your program. It's a great program.
Oh, thank you.
I stay tuned to all the programs as much as I can on BAI. But I'm a concerned citizen of these matters.
Yeah.
The matter of bike lanes and the oncoming onslaught of the bike itself, which is the first step of removing the car. Let's keep it straightforward, can we?
If you want to put it that way, sure. Let's go. Let's go from there.
Right. In a sense now. Okay, I'm not going to talk flat to you because we'll be talking all day. But I'm just saying, the bike now is a tool that, I'm going to say this now, that the white supremacist is using to move their means, because this didn't come from any people of color mindset. Can we say that?
I don't know that we can, that the bike is a tool of removal.
Okay.
Devised by white people.
Right. Correct.
To remove what? The car.
To remove the element that appears to be polluting the environment and is becoming in the way of other progressive idealisms when it comes to certain neighborhoods that certain people need to come back in the fold of.
But, okay, so I established earlier in the program that the bike lanes are primarily in wealthy areas, and the areas where there are lower incomes have historically been neglected by the city in terms of infrastructure. At the same time, these are neighborhoods, these neglected neighborhoods, at the same time, have a low rate of car ownership because, and I would argue, if you're looking for an instrument built by an insidious force to hold people down, you cannot invent a more perfect machine than the car. And, you know, the car is great if you're a wealthy, privileged person. Cars are very expensive to operate, to store, the fines associated with them, the mechanical work, the materials, everything about them. If you're not a wealthy, privileged person, yes, there are places, but, you know, to get really deep into it, there are places that have been neglected by transit, by other, and you need a car to get around or else.
True.
That is a terrible and unfortunate situation for people to be forced, especially in an urban environment. There's no excuse to force people to own these horrible money pits and the predatory lending associated with cars, the death on the streets that comes as a result of cars. I mean, you want to talk about housing and gentrification and prices and where people move and why they move. I understand why the car can seem like it's under assault by rich, privileged white people who ride bikes because, you know, I need a car to get around. But you look at what happens when you're forced to own a car. And I understand that, you know, it's easy to make a choice to look for cheaper housing and then buy a car to go along with that because, you know, we've set up a system, a really insidious system, where it's much easier to get a car and credit for a car than it is to get an affordable home. It's really hard to get a home. It's really hard to show that you have enough money to buy a home, or it's really hard to get, you know, show that you have the money to pay your rent, and you're going to be competing with other people who have more money and a landlord's not going to give you the lease. It's really hard. It's really, really hard. I know it's hard, especially in New York. It's really, really easy to go somewhere and get into a car. Someone is always going to put you into a car. So it's really a vicious cycle where people get forced further out. As they get forced out, they're forced into car ownership. And I you know, I think that is really, really what's at the heart of a lot of this stuff. And again, as I said in the beginning of the show, I understand the resentment of bike lanes. I like I said, I see it myself. When I come to a part of New York where there's tons of bike lanes, like part of me is angry. Why do they get this stuff? Why do these people get these bike lanes? And again, it's because I think the city, look, the city is not a benevolent entity, and they went about it in a shameful way, which is to put it in the wealthy areas first. And again, if they had taken the opposite approach, if they had said, you know, we're going to go to neighborhoods that are underserved by transit. When bike lanes first started really happening in earnest, we're going to go to neighborhoods that are underserved by transit. We're going to go to neighborhoods where people do not have cars, where there's low car rate owner. We are going to make these streets safer, and we're going to make it easier for people, you know, kids to get around safely. All of this, we're going to do this first. We would be having a totally different conversation today. I really believe that. But, okay. I thank you for your insight, and I thank you for the call. You have a lot of calls coming in. I'm going to take another. WBAI, you're on the air. What's your name? Where are you calling from?
Perry. I'm calling from Manhattan, but I'm originally from Brooklyn.
Oh, hi. Thank you for calling.
So I'm calling. I have a kind of in line, a little in line with your perspective, but since I'm also a black woman, and I'm also disabled.
Okay.
I have like a little different tape.
Mm-hmm.
So when I was coming up, everyone always rode bicycles.
Mm-hmm.
And I grew up in Brownsville. Then I was 11. We moved to Bedford-Stuyvesant.
Okay.
So everyone always had bicycles. We just had no protections for bicycles. So when you rode a bicycle, you know, you took your life in your hands because, of course, cars, you know, didn't respect people on bicycles. So when I moved to Manhattan in 2000, Bedford-Stuyvesant was just starting to gentrify. But like I said, my brothers, they were in their late 20s, and they always rode bicycles. Most of my friends always rode bicycles. I couldn't because I was disabled.
Mm-hmm.
So the fact that I got from them as bicycle riders is that they put these bicycles, A, in wealthy neighborhoods, like you pointed out, instead of in poorer neighborhoods first. That's what they should have done.
Mm-hmm.
They should have put the bike lanes in the poorer neighborhoods first.
Yes.
But they wanted to make money from the bicycle rentals because of what the cops have been doing. And, you know, I don't know if you touched upon this because I just started listening to your show
mm-hmm.
like 2 weeks ago.
Okay.
It's like cops routinely seize bikes from black and brown folks under bogus whatever.
Mm-hmm.
They don't have a helmet. They don't have this. The bike doesn't have. So they've been seizing that. So they see it as, you know, the gentrification thing as like, okay, these people can pay to rent these bikes. And you put them in mostly wealthier neighborhoods now that the areas are changing, you put these bike lanes in, but you didn't put them in for us before, which is what you had said.
Yeah.
So that's why they feel that is geared toward people, you know, that come here, geared toward people who gentrify the areas.
Yeah.
It's not that they resent them for having the bikes per se, but it's the way that it was put in. These weren't, you know, these areas have been redlined for so long, you know, especially East New York, Brownsville, and Bedford-Stuyvesant have been redlined so that even if you live in the community, you couldn't invest because the banks wouldn't give you any loans.
Yeah.
And the city wasn't fixing it up.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm coming at it from this perspective from people I know that ride bikes. It's like, you couldn't put these in when we were here.
Yes.
And even in 2000, when you started, you could have been putting in it because most poorer people in those areas don't drive, like you said. They use mass transit.
Yes. Yeah. No, I thank you for that. And yes, this is what I'm saying, that I understand that resentment. I absolutely understand that resentment. And I, as I said, I think it's shameful that that's the way it was done. And I do understand resenting them. I think I think that that's the unfortunate thing is that resentment has sort of, people have taken advantage of that to spin bike lanes as something that has caused this gentrification. Yes, it's sort of an amenity that has come along with gentrification, and I fully agree with being resentful of the way that came about. But yes, absolutely, and I thank you so much for that call and perspective. WBAI, you're on the air. What's your name? Where are you calling from?
Hi, I'm from the Bronx. My name is Israel, and I just want to make a few comments pertaining to the bike lanes in the city. I've
yeah.
been living in this city for the past 74 years.
Okay.
I'm 70 years old. Okay?
Yep.
So I've seen the changes. I've seen many changes. Like I said, I retired from city service, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And I was here way before they thought about putting in bike lanes. Bike lanes is a good thing and a bad thing, okay? You implement it, you install them, you try to enforce them. You're going to know a lot of rhetoric from the people who violate that bike lane, okay? And then again, bike lane is good, but where the hell are the trucks going to park? Where the hell double park to unload the merchandise into the establishments? Where are the people who are taxis and whatnot? They got to violate the rule and double park on a bike lane while they unload or pick up their passengers. So now you got one lane. okay? Mm-hmm. And they cannot go into the next lane because now they're going to obstruct the flow of traffic.
Mm-hmm.
So now again, now we got too much traffic in this city as it is.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
Too much, okay?
That's
so
for
now,
sure.
Even like Cuomo now, he wants all illegal immigrants, which I already see went by the DMC, and they were all around the block, you know? Illegal immigrants now can drive in the city and get licenses.
Okay. Okay? Well, yeah, I mean, you know, as far as undocumented immigrants getting licenses, you know, the fact of the matter is it's better if people are going to drive, they should be able to drive legally. So I think that that's a good thing. Your points about bike lanes, you know, taking up space that results in double parked trucks for deliveries, double parked taxis and so forth are valid. And I've talked about this a lot on the show that this is a failing. That what the city really needs to do is create, in addition to creating bike lanes, which they need to do, they also need to create more loading zones. And they are creating more loading zones. You know, there's piloting, for example. Look, we're in a culture now where a lot of stuff's being delivered directly to your home by UPS and so forth. So they are creating residential loading zones in certain neighborhoods. They're piloting these things, and these are things that need to happen. Yes, we need to better accommodate deliveries in addition to accommodating people getting around on bikes. We need to accommodate buses better, all of that. You know, all of that points back to one thing, which is the cars, which is the fact that we have too many cars in the city. So basically, we're looking at 100 years of really unrestrained car-oriented development in this city, where you have Robert Moses and the parkways and the expressways, and you have there was a time you couldn't park a car overnight in New York City in the early 20th century. Then you have parking available everywhere. You have expressways, highways. You have zoning that requires developers to include car parking in New York City and the densest city in America. They have to carve out space for private cars. So, you know, we're really backwards in that respect. We're finally coming around to this idea that you need more space for people to ride bikes. You need this, that, and the other thing. We are, in the meantime, just completely inundated. So I'm with you. You know, bike lanes, just like I think it's wrong to say that bike lanes are causing gentrification, it's wrong to say that bike lanes are causing traffic or the problem, or making it more difficult to deliver stuff or to drop off a taxi passenger. It's a car problem. It's too many private cars. And, you know, all of these things have to happen. We have to accommodate people getting around in other ways besides cars. We have to make better accommodations for that so that we can scale back the number of people driving. It's too many people driving. And whatever people want to think about gentrification, this, that, and the other thing, the numbers are very, very clear. The people driving are largely wealthier. Yes, not everybody driving is wealthy, far from it. But by and large, cars, parking, all of this stuff serves people who are far wealthier on average in New York City. I'm going to take one more call. WBAI, you're on the air. What's your name? Where are you calling from?
I'm Jocelyn from Brooklyn.
Hi.
I do understand why discrimination and racism endures. This is crazy. Bike lane has nothing to do with gentrification. I've done field work in this city for a long time. And as you said, the places where people are a little bit wealthier have the bike lane.
Yeah.
And that's where people can ride their bikes. And I grew up riding a bike in Haiti, and I tried to ride a bike here. I said, this is traveling with my coffin. Because
yeah.
Basically, anybody can hit you anywhere. So many people have been killed on bikes. My husband used to ride a bike, so he just parked it because he didn't feel safe, in spite of the fact that there are some streets that have bike lanes because people don't respect the bike lanes either. My entire neighborhood, they used to steal bikes because the kids wanted a bike to go around.
Mm-hmm.
So having a bike is great. And this lady mentioned storage places. Storage places came from greed, not from gentrification, because these people make more money out of having people store their stuff, as you said, that they're going to not use anymore. Because why would you want to store something that you're using? Okay.
Yes. Yes. Thank you so much. And thank you for that call and that perspective. I love the way you put all of that more perfectly and succinctly than I did in an hour of yammering on here. And I thank you so much for that insight. I want to just say very briefly, I want to thank everybody, but very briefly before I sign off, I wanted to get to e-bikes. We had a caller expressing concern with e-bikes going fast and so forth. Now, e-bikes, there was a bill that the state legislature passed over the summer to create a legal framework for e-bikes, certain types of e-bikes. Cuomo in his vanity vetoed it. And recently, this past week, announced he's got his own proposal, which is basically almost the same as the bill he vetoed. Cuomo likes to just kind of take things and rub them on himself to give them his scent and spit them back at you. So that's what he did. So Cuomo's got a proposal for legalizing e-bikes and different types of e-bikes and so forth. So that's coming down the pike, and I'm sure we'll talk more about that on a future program. But I want to thank everybody who listened and called in and such great insight, and it's a fascinating subject, in my opinion. So this has been Bike Snob with Evan Weiss. Thank you very much for listening, and ride safe out there.
Evan Weiss, Bike Snob, rubbing them on himself. That was very good. Evan Weiss, Mondays at 10 a.m. over listener-supported commercial-free community radio, WBAI at 99.5 FM, and streaming at WBAI.org. And I want to ask you to stay tuned for the next program, Living for the City, the one I host. We're going to be talking about Industry City, Sunset Park, and rezoning proposals. Some of what was discussed in this current hour. So do stay tuned for Living for the City, coming up in just a couple of minutes. My name is Michael G. Haskins. WBAI is listener-supported, commercial-free, resistance radio, challenging norms and defying them. Let's break down what that means. It means that no clandestine corporate entity tells me how to do my show. You better believe that. It means that you, the listener, and the diverse WBAI community have a voice which reverberates across the tri-state area. You drive this station, so fuel us. Donate by visiting give2wbai.org or pledge right now from your smartphone by texting the letters WBAI to 41444. And thank you for your support.
This is Phil Donahue, and you're listening to WBAI New York, 99.5.
Took away our children.
Was Sincero. This is John Kane from Let's Talk. On Thursday, January 30th, 7 p.m., I'll be screening a film that captures the raw truth of the U.S. and Canadian residential schools. Indian Horse relays the horrors of the 100-year residential school era and the racism that allowed them. Come join me for my first WBAI event of the year featuring Indian Horse at 7 p.m. Thursday, January 30th at the Brooklyn Commons, 388 Atlantic Avenue in Brooklyn, New York.
Building Bridges, your community and labor report. From your workplace to your neighborhood, listen to the show that brings it all together. Building Bridges, your